Well, Tommy doesn't believe that I can type 60 words a minute with two fingers, so he's going to put me on the speed test tomorrow. I'll show him. I can do it. I might even go past 60 words a minute. Back in a moment, we'll take your phone calls with Professor James McCanney, physicist on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. I'm George Norrie with Professor James McCanney. Jim, you didn't talk about your DVD, which goes with this book.
Oh, okay, yes. What happened is when I did a pre-release of the book and the material, and I want to mention too that the mathematical release of this to inner circles of mathematicians was done some time ago. The release of the book right now is the release for the general public. But in after the inner circle release, then I gave it to some trained scientists, mathematicians, and even they were starting to have a little problem with it, putting all the different pieces together, because there's a number of new mathematical concepts in it. And so I thought, well, gee, how can I possibly release this to the general public? So I got the idea to do a DVD lecture. So it's a 3-hour DVD lecture that goes in the front cover of the book. And I take every topic and I break it down and show examples on a whiteboard, talking about how the processes work and giving examples. So that was why the DVD came about, was to, and it's much easier for people to sit down and watch the DVD than to try and read a book that,
It's pretty technical overall, but it's also written though for the average person.
Right. And so the idea is that I've actually gotten it down to where I can teach kids how to calculate prime numbers and how to take a prime number out of a table and identify why it's there, how it's related to many other prime numbers. And they're actually in families, many different families of prime numbers. So it's a the DVD was to just make it more palatable
All
for
right.
the public.
Here we go, James. A whole hour of phone calls for you now. We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line first. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jay from SorceryNet IRC.
Hey, Jay.
I have a question for James. I was wondering what your take on the planet Mars and why it was dead, and I'll take the answer offline.
Why it is dead? Is that was the
Yeah,
question?
why there's no life found on Mars and what happened to it?
Well, there may be an inkling of life. We don't really know that for sure, but very clearly, as far as I'm concerned, the ancients talk about Mars being a blue planet. So this was in historical times. They also talk about a large comet coming by Mars and literally sucking the water and atmosphere off of it. And they saw this from a distance. And then it became the red planet we see today. And if you look at Mars, the riverbeds, the erosion, I've got many pictures especially from the early satellite photos of tremendous erosion on Olympus Mons, the big volcano, very pristine riverbeds that are meandering through the Martian highlands. All of the indications that Mars was covered with water, but very recently. And recently is the key. I'm not talking about millions of years ago. I'm talking about thousands of years ago. And Mars is starting to recover, but these are events that happen. This is the way solar systems are built. This is the way solar systems events are very devastating. And Earth has seen these kind of events also and has recovered. Mars is recovering right now. Mars will regain an atmosphere. It will regain water and oceans, but it's going to take millions of years for Mars to recover.
Do you believe the asteroid belt is an exploded planet object or a planet that never formed, as some scientists believe?
Well, I think once we get out there and start looking at these pieces, and just like, say, you get a 4,000-piece puzzle and you pour it out on the table, and within hours you have it all put together. If we get out to enough asteroids, we'll be able to pretty much determine that these pieces came from a certain single item or object out there. And eventually, probably not in our lifetimes, but future generations of spacefarers will go out and actually be able to tell. But additionally, asteroids are captured. We know capture is a process that works in the solar system. And so some of these objects are captured. It's a real mix out there. But there's a good chance that something did get really nailed out there and exploded. And a lot of the asteroids are, in fact, from a single body that maybe existed between Mars and Jupiter at one time.
Okay, next up, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with Jim McKinney. Hi.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Calling from Bellingham, Washington.
Okay.
And got some synchronicities here for you, George and James, along with the Planet X. In your handbook, I have the Planet X Incoming Earth Changes, James.
Yes.
I bought that, I think, in 2003. The date that you give in there for, you know, using the new calendar timeline is my birthday. My birthday is January 11th, the date that you used in the handbook. Another synchronicity is last week I went to the public library and was going through the free books, and I picked up this book, and I knew I'd seen the name before. It's Velikovsky Reconsidered.
Oh, yeah.
By editors of Pensée.
Great.
And I was just, and I'm like, Velikovsky. And I went back to my Coming Earth Changes, Planet X, and you referenced Velikovsky. So, I mean, ever since I've, you know, heard of you, and there's always been a connection. Like, with my birthday, I was like, you know, I've always been one step ahead in everything in my life, just because of the synchronicities that go on. And just finding this book, you know, and I had an inkling on my way home, James McKinney flashed in my head, and I turned on Coast to Coast. Sure enough.
Yeah. So another synchronous event tonight of turning on the radio, and
there you are.
Well,
and to top it off, about 3-4 years ago on my way home, I called in to George on my way home from Seattle, and at the end of the conversation, I asked if he's ever heard of James McKinney. He's like, well, I'll look into it.
That's right.
Remember that, George?
Yep, sure do. And here he is.
Here I am, and here he is. We've come full circle.
So true. So
all right, well, I just wanted to share that, and keep up the good work, James.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, George. Good night.
Okay, appreciate you being on the show. Let's go to our first-time caller line. It's your turn. Hi there.
Good evening, George.
Hi.
I just have a few quick comments and then a question, and I'll get off the air to listen to it. I'm a fellow 1950. I guess you're from about that era.
Sure.
I type at 45 Hutton Peck words a minute with gusts up to about 55, and I believe you can do the 60.
Yeah, I mean, it's not 100% accurate, but I could get my 60 in.
My dad is a 93-year-old Federal Radio Commission pioneer, got me hooked on radio years ago, and you have one of the best shows I've ever heard. The bumper music, there's probably 1 out of 1,000 that I don't like. The rest is great.
Thank you.
Here's an interesting thing. The St. Louis Arch is some kind of an upside-down chain. There was a big show on that, and you probably could find out about that.
Huh.
But here's my question. It's Catena. There's our mathematical friend Jim is probably can find out. My wife is a prime number hobbyist, so she's going to look forward to this book. And I do patronize just about every one of the sponsors on this show. But here's the big question. Let's say Ian Punnett on Saturday night punches the time clock at 1 o'clock. He punches out at 5 o'clock. He's going to work 4 hours and get paid for 5, or work 3 hours
and
get paid for 4.
We'll make sure we take care of that.
George, thanks for everything.
All right, appreciate it.
But he will lose it next year on the reverse.
It is going to be interesting to see what happens.
Well,
I mean, now that you've kind of warned us of the possibilities.
Yeah, like I say, many people will go through this and not affect them at all. It depends on how complicated your life is and how much your life depends on scheduling that's locked somewhere in that computer system. And all of a sudden, you know, you're the one that it affects.
All right, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to the program. You're on with Jim McKinney. Hi.
Hi, George.
Hey.
Hey, James, I had a question for you. You had mentioned at the beginning of the show that asteroids bring viruses, or that they're capable of bringing viruses onto the Earth.
Right.
Okay. Well, my question is, wouldn't that, you know, when they enter the atmosphere, wouldn't they burn off?
Good question. Jim, well, how come? Why won't they be killed? I mean, well, they're coming in, they're, you know, in searing heat.
Correct, but that happens. Oops.
Go ahead, Jim.
That happens relatively quickly, and also things could be locked deep inside of that object so that they would be protected on their way in. So
it depends, like some casing, huh?
Right, and how large is the object and how deep in within the object the viruses might be. In fact, they might even mutate coming in with that high heat. So hard to say exactly what could happen. I don't think we know a lot about those types of situations, but with the Venus situation, we are in the tail of Venus. That's why and the tail of Venus extends way out. Earth has a magneto tail, they call it. That's the scientific name. It's actually big comet tail, literally. But in that tail, the viruses are forming. The conditions are there, the electrical conditions and the materials, the basic building blocks are there. And if you randomly let these objects or these atoms and molecules form with enough energy to build up the building blocks, they're going to form a whole litany of viruses and small entities like that. So,
Jim, you're as sharp as a tack tonight.
Am I?
Yes.
I am wide awake, I should say that, but it might be because that where I am, it's very early.
Where are you?
I'm west of you.
You won't tell us where, will you?
Well, let's put it this way. If the Earth were flat, I'd be able to see Japan. So,
Wildcard Line, you're up with us. Hi there. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
I'm Pam from Bossier City, Louisiana.
Go ahead,
Pam. I have a theory, and I haven't heard anyone mention it yet. I've always known that we are hurling through space. By we, I mean the solar system at, what, 1,000? I always thought it was 196,000 miles an hour, but I think it's only about, what, 1,000 miles an hour?
No, I don't know, Jim.
And it was something like that. And so is our universe hurling through space. Could we just be going through a warmer place in space that's causing it? And it's not a global thing. It's like a universal thing.
Well,
that's causing the Earth to warm, or even Mars. They said last night. Or, I hear that several of the planets. You know, maybe it's not the sun, but a warmer place in the universe.
Well, Pam, let me tell you something. Back in the 90s, I worked with some Russian scientists out of a university in central Russia called Novosibirsk. And they were studying exactly that, a guy named Alexei Dmitriev. And they were projecting that, in fact, the whole solar system was encountering different energy levels in the galaxy.
Right.
And we were moving. We do move relative to the center of the galaxy. We're not moving very fast. But as far as we're concerned, we're moving very fast relative to speeds we would talk about here on Earth. And those conditions change, and they influence the solar system and the sun. And that was their point.
Okay,
that
they were... I understand it could affect the sun. But I was just wondering if it could be, you know, not necessarily a global warming thing, but a spatial or universal warming thing.
Well,
And I'm glad to hear that someone thought of it, because I've been waiting to hear about it on the radio and never did. And George, by the way, the other night you said, oh, and it's a pleasure to speak to you, by the way. I'm a great admirer of yours.
Well, thank you.
You were worried about Jesus' middle initial being H?
Yeah.
We always knew it was Jesus Horatio Christ.
Horatio?
We were growing up, and everybody would use it so that it wouldn't be blasphemous,
yeah,
I guess. But the H always, we always, and I thought everybody knew, it stood for Horatio.
Okay, I never knew that.
And I know the other night I couldn't reach on the computer, so I said next time I speak to him, I'm going to bring it up.
Horatio.
Yeah, I'm worried about this global warming thing because it sure is cold outside.
All right, thanks. Appreciate you calling in, Jim McKinney. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, Jim, George, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
You know, I don't know, tell me what you think of this. I look at this with everything that's been going on with like an Occam's razor theory that now we're discovering all this stuff and it's so complicated they're making it. I think that, you know, there's a cycle. Once it's, you know, like you said before about where do you think these great salt lakes come? There was an ocean there. Once in a while, you know, millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years or whatever. It's like Earth just gets tired or the other planets and they just give a shake and we're going to start all over again because, you know, what, you know, you watch the thing on the Mayans, how they, you know, we're not the first civilization that, you know, that's going to destroy itself. It's, I don't know, when I look at it, it doesn't seem all that complicated. It just seems pretty natural, actually. Is that an odd theory or what? And I'm going to get off the line to hear your answer and have a good night.
Okay, Jim, a minute to go before the break.
Well, natural is the perfect word for it because I believe that nature's method is one of generation and then a destruction and then a rebuilding. And this is the way nature works to generate new species, to generate change. And it's just the way nature works, whether it's a hurricane or a tornado or a glaciation period or global warming. Change is the order of the day with nature. Constance is not nature's way. It's change, and radical change sometimes is nature's mode of operation.
Okay, appreciate that. Jim, the book Calculate Primes, where do you get it?
Well, the webpage, calculateprimes.com, and if people have a link to my homepage, right at the top, there's a link from there also. So, and that's, of course, linked up from the Coast to Coast webpage. So it is now available and a little write-up there so people understand what it's all about. But people are going to, it'll take people a while to understand the significance of this. Let me put it that way.
So they'd have to read it a couple times.
Yes, and then understand the ramifications of what this book is saying and the implications.
Okay, stay with us. We'll be back. We'll take final phone calls. What a fast night, almost zooming by like a comet. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, John Robbins joins us. Think of his last name for a moment. Baskin-Robbins, that's right. He's the heir to the Baskin-Robbins fortune, and he's going to talk about the environment and health and the dietary link between all of that. It'll be fascinating. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, 2 years ago, the hurricane season was just horrible, Jim. It was calm last year. Do you want to make a prediction for this year?
Well, I've looked at the alignments, the electrical alignments in the solar system here, and August around the 19th could be a significant time. We've got a whole series of cross solar system alignments that could affect the current flow through the solar system. And of course, we're in that August return current sheet at that time. And then it, oddly enough, around December, and I can't remember the dates. I don't have the numbers right in front of me here, but I remember that December next year would be another date, set of dates in there where we have some interesting planetary alignments that we have not seen really for a couple of years.
Even though the hurricane season ends the end of November.
Right.
So that's fascinating.
Right. Well, and if we look at this past weekend, the severe storms we had on Earth, we had the full moon, which was aligned on the far side of Earth. And also, we are 6 months out of the August cycle, and it turns out that February can be a very active tornado month, although people don't usually recognize
right.
it.
Right. Okay, back to the phones we go. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yes, this is Tony.
Hi, Tony. Where are you calling from?
Well, I'm calling from Cerritos, Los Angeles, and I'll post a question to Jim.
All right.
And then I'll get off the phone and listen to his answer. My question was, the moon being a smaller body than the Earth, if a comet would come very close to it, hit it, or is it possible it could send it towards Earth? Also, the same thing would apply, a large comet, a small planet hitting Earth and knocking us off orbit, or a large asteroid towards the sun. So could it happen, and could there be interaction between the moon and the Earth if that happened? And that's my question. What would happen, and how much would it take to knock us off of orbit and towards the sun?
All right, very good question, Tony. Jim, what do you think?
Well, to actually send us towards the sun, we would need a something, let's put it this way, something the same size as Earth coming at us when we're moving around our orbit, something coming at us coming at the same speed. They would collide, and all the majority of the stuff would then fall towards the sun. So it would be a pretty big interaction. Short of that, it would be very difficult to send us heading towards the sun. In the same way with the moon, if something came, the moon is in orbit around us, imagine an object coming in, hitting the moon directly nose on and going at the same speed that the moon is moving around us, then all of that material or a lot of it would fall directly to Earth. But those are pretty difficult conditions to achieve. Typically what would happen is something would come by, something that big, and it would perturb our orbits to change them, but not. In fact, it's interesting to see that the moon's orbit is off kilter by 6 degrees from the normal plane of the planet. So it obviously something happened to the moon during its history to send it off. You would expect it to be in the same plane as all the rest of the planets, but its orbit is 6 degrees off from the plane of the planet.
Why
so something happened there.
Jim, why do they say if the moon wasn't where it is, exactly where it is, we wouldn't have life the way we know it today? Why?
Well, one big reason is the magnetic field. And when I was at Cornell, there was a guy there named Stan Dermott who was a proponent that the moons generate the magnetic fields, and it was an empirical thing with him, but it's very true. If you look at all the planets, the ones that have magnetic fields have moons in proportion to the moons, Jupiter having the most. Saturn has a fairly big moon, Titan, and a whole cast of other smaller moons, and it has a pretty good magnetic field. But then you look at the other outer planets, Uranus, Neptune, and they really don't have magnetic fields, and they don't have much for a moon system. Earth has a big moon. We have a high magnetic field. And the magnetic field on Earth is key to protecting us from all of those dangerous things that come off the sun, the high-energy wind that comes off. And that builds up our ionosphere, which then blocks the X-rays and the ultraviolet light. So there's a whole litany of things that happen because the moon is there.
Let's go to our wild card line. Your turn. Hello there.
Hi, this is Robert from Fort Lauderdale. Robert. I have a really quick question for Jim. You were talking about comets and being stuck in the tail for 30 days. Now, from what I understand in space, what I've always understood is everything moves very quickly in space. We always hear that a little paint chip could crack a shuttle window or a golf ball could bring down a satellite. How would a comet, how could we stay in a comet's tail for 30 days if everything moves so fast in space?
Well, the answer is we are moving fast, but these comet tails, the big ones, I'm talking about the big ones, not the Halley's comets, but the big ones, like the Hale-Bopp tail was, I don't remember how wide, but it's probably could be 20 million miles wide. So it's going to take us, literally, we could spend 20 to 30 days moving through one of these comet tails. And that's the key. The big comets have big, wide tails. And so it's going to take us quite a few days, if not weeks, to move through a big comet tail.
Would it pollute our atmosphere, or once we passed it, would we be in the clear?
No, we have seen these pollution events before while passing through comet tails, and in fact, that is where oil comes from. That's where the flood, the great flood, those type of situations, that is what Velikovsky talks about, is the pollution event that occurred on Earth. And the hydrocarbons, you see them in the comet tail and just about every other chemical, wide variety of chemicals, I should say, that build up in the comet tail. And in fact, we would experience, besides water, which is the most common element of a comet tail, we would experience a pollution event of hydrocarbons, nitrogen, hydrogen compounds, ammonia, methane, you name it, it would come pouring in.
Well, thank you for that very clear answer.
Okay, next up, let's go to our next wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hello there, good morning.
Good morning, George. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thanks for having on your guest tonight.
Thank you.
James, I wanted to, first of all, congratulate you on your book, Calculate Primes. I was fascinated. I immediately went to the website when you mentioned it, and I wanted to ask you about encryption and the idea of factoring of products of two very large prime numbers. If your work on calculating primes has any impact on something I'm sure you're aware of called the RSA factoring challenge and the solving of these solutions to these products of prime numbers.
Right. Well, here's one of the fallouts of what I've done. You can take any number in the typical method of figuring out if it's prime or not is called factorization. You start dividing by 3, then 5, then 7, and so on, and then you go all the way up to about the square root of that number, and of course, with a huge number, that's going to take you supercomputing power time, tremendous amount of calculations to perform. With what I've done, you take that same number, you subtract, I've discovered what are called magic numbers, and there are an infinite number of these, but you take a magic number that is close to the prime number, you subtract it, and within a couple subtraction calculations, you can determine if the number is prime or not, or you can determine what the factors are. So factorization is now defined in terms of addition and subtraction. So it's just one of the offshoots of this. And encryption is not going to go under soon, but one of the chapters in the book is called Encryption, Is It Doomed? And my read on that is that it's good for me to release this information because the encryption systems that are being used today are faulty. They're not 100% foolproof, and therefore we need much better encryption encoding techniques and encryption techniques. So yes, it's going to affect how all of these operations are done, finding large prime numbers, pairs of primes. It's going to you can determine if prime numbers are prime or not very easily now.
Well, thank you very much, James. I really appreciate that. And it's amazing. Among all the things that you've shared tonight, this one may, in fact, be the most momentous, in fact, of all the things you've shared. So thanks again, George and James, for writing the book. I'm going to be getting it in the DVD.
Well, thank you. And like I say, people are not going to recognize the importance of this book, this little book. They're not going to recognize the importance of this for a while, and it's going to hit like a ton of bricks when people finally figure out what this is all about.
Do you have to understand mathematics, Jim, in order to understand the book?
No. No, it's really written. I tried to bring it down to maybe a third, fourth, or fifth grade level of mathematics, and it's all you have to
understand.
Well,
that's about 2 more years higher than me, for crying out loud.
Or some people, but no, I've tried to bring this down to basic arithmetic, addition and subtraction, and when people see the simplicity in the primes, this has been locked in there for 2,500 years, and believe me, when I started putting all these pieces together, it took me a long time but the hair was standing up on the back of my neck because I realized what I had done. This is something every great mathematician has worked on, some of them their entire lives. People like Gauss and Riemann. And so to be able to boil this down to a simple technique that even a grade school math student could understand, this is...
But a good math student.
a good math student.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies. You're up with us. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is Sal from New York City calling.
Sure.
I have a question about about subatomic particles, something I don't understand. I've read that the thing that keeps them together, adheres them, is something called a gluon. But the gluons, millions and millions of them hold like only two subatomic particles together. So what are the gluons made of? They're obviously much smaller than the subatomic particles.
There's a whole factory of subatomic particles, but the typical answer is that the nuclei are held together with what's known as the short range force. It's a very short range force between the nuclei of the atoms. And then, of course, you have the protons, which are trying to repel each other because they're positively charged. So you have the neutrons sprinkled in there, and they basically allow that nucleus, the short range forces, to hold the nucleus together. But once you get too large, then the short range forces don't work anymore because the nucleus is too large and the nuclei start breaking apart. But there's a whole laundry list of subatomic particles, and I'm not sure that we really understand fully how they all work.
Thank you.
Okay, Sal, let's go to a few more callers, and then that's it for the night, Jim. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Good morning.
Hello. This is Matt from Billings, Montana.
Hi, Matt. Go ahead, sir.
I just had a question for Jim. I've been watching a lot of stuff on the History Channel lately, and I watched a thing the other night. They say that in the year 2012, the Earth is going to be passing through a galactic equator, kind of, you know, an equator through the universe. And I was just wondering if that, you know, had anything to do with global warming because, you know, the closer you get to the equator on the Earth, the warmer it gets. So I was just wondering if that had anything to do with it.
George, I think I mentioned this a little, touched on this earlier in the show, but we go through the same alignment every year. And we have been for a long time, and we will for a long time after 2012. There's nothing magical about 2012 in the galactic sense, in the galactic alignments or whatever, that would make it any different from any other year in recent or future history, so to speak. So there's simply nothing magical about 2012 other than it is a cycle. And once again, when you're dealing with the Mayan calendar, people don't understand calendars. I think you have people that don't understand that the Mayan calendar cannot be interpolated back 4,000 years. It simply cannot be done because it didn't even start back then. The Mayan calendars they're dealing with now were only started within 1,000 years of right now.
Okay, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Final moments to go. Go ahead, please.
Hello, this is Jeff from Portland, Oregon.
Okay, Jeff.
And my question revolves around repeating numbers. If we look at pi, and we've got a 10-numeral system, and as you extrapolate pi further and further out, there's never any repeating patterns. If we had a 5-numeral system, or let's say a 20-numeral system, would the number that would function as pi in those systems exhibit similar characteristics of not repeating itself?
Let me think about that for just a second. Well, yes, and in fact, it would translate into a pure real number, as they're called, a non-rational number, one that you cannot break down into a factor. Into a quotient, let's say, of one number over the other. And that's basically what you're asking. But there are some numbers that have repeating digits that are in fact infinite numbers. They repeat and repeat and never end. And those are pure real numbers also. So to answer your question, pi, I guess, like a rose by any other name, is still pi, and it would be an infinite series no matter what number system you chose.
Jim, as we wrap things up here, I want to thank you for being on the program. Of course, you're always enlightening, as we say. You're very uncanny.
Well, thank you, Joyce. I try and keep some aspect of, you know, keeping ahead of the crowd, so to speak.
Well, you are. You're ahead of the curve, and you're out of the box. And that's the important thing. Jim, take care of yourself. Keep in touch with us, all right?
Okay, George. I will do that. And thanks again for the time on the show. It's always a great pleasure to be a guest.
If there is major computer problems after this weekend, I'm going to call you Monday and get you back on.
Okay.
All right? If not, run for the hills.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.